Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Ellen Bradbury about the Santa Fe Writers Conference. I'm happy now to welcome William Powers. He is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. He is the author of several books, the latest of which is 12 by 12, a one-room cabin off the grid and beyond the American dream. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a very, very interesting and profound book in many ways. You started, the way it starts is after years of working in Africa and Latin America, doing development work and conservation work, you ended up in North Carolina living for 40 days in a 12 by 12 foot cabin belonging to a doctor who had decided to live off the grid and do permaculture and really embrace the way of life that reflected her values. Who was this doctor, and what drew you to her place and her way of living?
Well, she's a fascinating and inspiring person who I met actually through my parents when I was down in North Carolina. They mentioned her as kind of a local celeb in the sense that she's taking this alternative lifestyle, and she's got a very interesting sort of spiritual philosophy as well, and I went out there to talk to her. And one thing led to the next, and we got along great, and she invited me to stay in the 12 by 12 house while she was traveling out west, and I did, and that's how it all started.
So she lived in a 12 by 12 cabin because that was the size that was just small enough that it was considered a shed and not subject to building codes and plumbing and electricity and all of those kinds
right.
of things. And I found it fascinating that when you first saw her and met her, she was practically, I mean, loving the honeybees around her, and there was this beautiful thing. And then you saw the cabin and thought, oh my God, this is so small that it's unbearable.
You know, it was a shock, really. It was almost like looking down the blade of a razor, or it was just blending into the background. It was so slight against her two-acre area. Especially after having driven past McMansions and so on my way out there, it just didn't seem possible that in the middle of America you could live so simply. So I was a bit startled, but, you know, it's funny. When she invited me inside for tea at first, I almost didn't want to go in because I felt it would be almost uncomfortable to have two people in such a small house. But when I got in there, it was surprisingly roomy. And we sat there and talked for a couple of hours. She's got her great-grandmother's rocking chair in there, several bookshelves. You know, and it's actually spacious because there's a loft above where the bed is, and you can fit a lot in there. And the other advantage of a 12-by-12 house, if it's 12-by-12 or smaller, you don't have to pay property taxes because it's not considered to be a house. So some of the people doing this in that part of North Carolina are doing it also for that reason.
And she also made a decision to make $11,000 a year or less so she wouldn't have to pay taxes that would go into weapons and other things that she didn't believe in.
Yeah, exactly. It's a form of tax resistance to lower your income to a certain level where you can't be taxed. You know, before that, she'd sort of taken $10.40 off of her 1040 each year and done other sort of symbolic tax resistance measures with her kids. But once they grew up, she decided to take this even more radical step of reducing a very high physician's salary down to $11,000.
So how did it come to be that you moved in there?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I was about to head back to New York City, where I live most of the year now, and I got this letter. You know, it was a handwritten letter from her that she'd written by candlelight in the 12 by 12, and it was this beautiful letter. And at the end, she said, you know, I almost forgot the most important thing. You know, I'm leaving for the West. You're welcome to stay any amount of time you want, you know, and there's no keys, of course, and really lock. But I just decided that, you know, I had to accept this challenge. I had to, like, I was feeling quite depressed, actually, and quite maladjusted when I got back from 10 years working abroad. I was in Latin America and Africa. And just coming back to the States, you know, just seeing all the developments, the strip malls and highways and everything else, it just seemed so out of line with Mother Nature, you know? And I've been living in what I call soft world societies, like these indigenous cultures around the world that are in harmony. And I've also been seeing the effects of climate change abroad. For example, down in Bolivia, the glaciers are visibly melting. If you go up to the Chacaltaya ski resort, there's no longer any snow up there any time of the year. So you can't ski, and the resort closed. And it's affecting the water supply for 2 million people in that country. And, you know, I'm thinking that this machine, this sort of industrial economy we have here, is what's causing those problems in Bolivia and around the world. So I was feeling almost guilty, you know, the fact that I'm part of the society that's, you know, if everyone lived the way the average American lived, we need 5 additional planets to sustain everyone. So I think what it was is when I got this invitation, this handwritten letter from this physician to stay in the 12 by 12, it was like a challenge to live in a different way, to push my own boundaries and to see how this works in a very intimate way.
And in her letter to you, she had included a Mary Oliver poem which had the words, "Inside this soft world."
Right,
and
exactly.
It's such a beautiful and strange quotation and phrase that popped out at you, as it did to her, which is why she wrote it to you, having lived in such a harsh world as you had done.
Well, it's, you know, the idea of the Mary Oliver poem that I include, you know, she's talking about the soft world, which is kind of a puzzle and kind of a clue. Like, as my time there developed, and as the book 12 by 12 develops, it's unpacked. And really what it is it's sort of an alternative metaphor to New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman's idea of the flat world. You know, his best-selling book, The World is Flat. No, this physician says, and a lot of people are saying, the world is not flat. We don't have to create a one-world uniplanet, you know, or we don't have to flatten the world's cultures and the environment just to have more technology and more stuff. We can, in fact, have a world that's more textured and rich and diverse in a lot of ways. And I think that a lot of the questions that are asked in the book and answered in the book have to do with how to live in that way.
There's an example when you were kind of considering this Thomas Friedman idea that the world is flat and the fallacy that technology can save us and equalize everybody, which people always hope for and never really seems to happen, that you give an example of being at a wedding that was conducted by a Bolivian shaman who mm-hmm. asked you what the shape of the world was. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, it was a beautiful moment right on the banks of Lake Titicaca, looking out towards Peru with these islands shimmering in the distance and llamas grazing. And you know, he asked me, what is the shape of the world? And, of course, I indicated with a sort of downward circle in front of my chest that the world is round. And he said, yes, it's round, but we say it's round in a different way in our indigenous culture. And he said, it's round like this. And he did the circle upwards from his belly up to his chest, and the world took that shape, you know, the roundness of the hills coming up into the sky. And he said, we also say it's round like this. And he took his fingers in front of his chest, and he went outwards, and the world took that shape as he said it. It was contouring out to both sides. And he said, but we also say it's round like this. And he left his fingers in front of him, and he brought them back into his heart. And the idea is, I think, the outer world circling beautifully into our inner world. So I asked him, well, which of the three shapes is it? You know, what shape is the world? And he answered with a question. He said, what is the shape of the world? He threw the question back at me. And so I was exploring that idea, but it's just, to me, a much more beautiful and rich metaphor of roundness and softness than the idea of the flat world.
I was thinking also when I was reading that there is a thing which we like, which is scientific objectivity, which proves that the world is, in fact, round and the exact shape of it and its orbit around the sun and the moon's orbit around us and all of those things that are real and true. But when I was reading that story, it brought back to me that the point of reference for everything, including science, is the human apparatus, the human mind, the human heart.
Sure, that's a great point. Absolutely.
So one of the things that you were doing when you entered this cabin was just walking around. And one of the things that I noticed was, and I was sort of thinking about it in relation to my own life and the lives of those around me, was you stopped multitasking. What was that process like?
Right. Well, I didn't know what to do when I first got there to the 12 by 12 and was alone. I mean, you know, when you strip everything away, you know, what's left? It's this sort of radical simplicity. And I stopped multitasking. I slowed down. I started listening more to the soundscape around me, you know, the creek, no-name creek flowing by, the sound of the trees, the sound of the animals. Also her neighbors, you know, some of the folks that are also doing wildcrafting experiments on the creative edge, listening to them. And taking these long ambles, these long walks in the tradition of sauntering, you know, the great American tradition of Walt Whitman, just sauntering for miles and miles and without any destination at all. You know, and that's where I kind of discovered more of this leisure ethic that exists over there. It's in contrast to the sort of work ethic that we all know about. The leisure ethic puts idleness first. And I began to see how that creates a much more rich life when work comes second to leisure. Because really, like, doing nothing is about the most environmental thing you can do in some ways. I mean, just coming into harmony, focusing not just on having and doing, but also on being. And I think that's what our culture has lost in a lot of ways, is that third piece there. And we need to bring that back, bring back the simple beingness.
It was interesting to me that when you were talking to this doctor whose cabin you were living in right at the beginning, and we're looking at her garden and beginning to understand how her garden worked, it was really built for the least amount of work. And that's part of what the permaculture ethic is all about.
Yeah, that's right. The way that she used contours and multi-story agriculture, certain plants shading others so that they will not lose water as quickly. I mean, all of this is actually done to leave a lot of free time. You know, so it was kind of on autopilot, which was amazing. You know, the idea is not to become a sun-up to sundown slave on the farm and just keep doing more and more work for the sake of work. It's like once you've lowered, like she's lowered her expenses to almost nothing. I mean, for her house, it only cost $7,000 to build a very nice 12 by 12. That's with like cedar walls and very beautiful place. Plus $10,000 for the land, 2 acres on a creek. So $17,000 and she's got it paid off. So, you know, with that kind of simplicity, you also don't need, like she talks a lot about how, you know, why is it that we work all these hours just to buy a whole bunch of stuff? It doesn't make sense, even on a purely selfish level, you know, a purely egotistical level. Why would you do that?
We're talking to William Powers about his book, 12 by 12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. The surroundings that you were in, I mean, you were on this 2-acre piece of land, but you also had all kinds of neighbors, both people who were doing organic farming and things like that, but also kind of horrifying and very smelly factory farming chicken right. installation.
What a contrast. The tension between my neighbors who were organic farming with free-range chickens of all different varieties and hogs and everything just, you know, small scale, like in the Jeffersonian tradition of small freeholders. And then every once in a while, the wafting smell of the chicken factories, the gold-kissed factories, these enormous houses with, you know, 100,000 birds who live in darkness their whole life and just like the fans blowing the smell out. You know, so I was struggling between sort of free-range and industrial agriculture. Like, what does this mean? To have these two competing visions in the same place.
Tell us about your neighbors. There was one set of neighbors who were escaping a kind of rough, violent trailer park existence.
Right. They were trying to learn how to become organic farmers, and it was a difficult endeavor. So they had 6 kids. They're the Thompsons. And, they were getting into hogs and chickens and other types of livestock, taking classes at the community college on how to do this, how to do permaculture and sustainable agriculture, and really trying to escape that, you know, drug-addled violence past that they had. So I talk about their experiments and what happens with them.
And there were all sorts of, it was kind of a multicultural, multi-ethnic neighborhood, which at the beginning sounds great, but it wasn't without its tensions.
Right, that's true. There were definitely some racial tensions. In fact, the area nearby this 12 by 12 area is Siler City, where there was the anti-Latino riots several years ago. And there's a protest like where the Latino people in the area, who mostly work in the chicken factories, actually, and then a lot of these industrial plants, they would march with the statue of Mary through the streets, and that caused huge protests because the white residents were saying, this is not the way that it's done. That's more of a let. So there's also that tension. But I would say, like, this community where I was, they've worked through a lot of those issues. And, like, actually, there was a Honduran neighbor and African-American and a white family, and then this doctor living all together, you know, generally finding a kind of a harmony.
So the world we live in is filled with horror and always has been, but there's a particular kind of horror that you describe in the book and that probably is that we're all conscious of, namely the destruction of the natural world and the kind of paving over and plasticizing of the earth and the horror of the death machines of nuclear weapons and other kinds of weapons. And some of what you were grappling with when you were there in this house, you found a way to deal with that using these little, first of all, the books, but also the spiritual teachings that this doctor had written down on little cards in her house. And you, I mean, there was so much in that, and each one of them kind of pops out at you at a different time, and the way sort of coincidences turn out not to be coincidences sometimes when wisdom comes to you. One of the things that I found interesting was the process of coming to consider alternatives to out-and-out fighting with the so-called enemy.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like, choosing neither to fight nor to acquiesce?
Right. It's a tension that's very hard to resolve. But the idea is that whenever you oppose something directly, you're kind of energizing the enemy, the quote-unquote enemy. You know, so by like either violently or just with anger opposing, say, nuclear weapons or environmental destruction of whatever kind, you know, you're giving power to that other side. So it's like her philosophy is see, be, do. First you see the problem, you know, whatever it is. Then you just come into a clear space and you are. You accept the fact that in this moment, this is what's happening, right? And then you do. You act out of that clear space. So that really it's a more of a compassionate action in the tradition of like Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi or something like that, where it's a both actually, you know, negativity and anger, that can also lead to change, you know, protesting and so on. But in some ways it's a lower level of change. If you can come at it with love and compassion, it's a much more durable and higher frequency change that comes about.
I think that is maybe true or probably true, but how do you know it's true?
Well, you know, I mean, I would say I know from my own personal experience the times that I've approached something with love and with caring and understanding. It's like I just feel the transformation happening at a deeper level, you know, and I think that's the way this physician, Jackie Benton, talks about it too. Is that it's like it's this knowing, this inner knowing that's happening.
I mean, there's change within yourself, but then there's also change in the outer world. What are you saying also when you come at these big fights with love and compassion that more durable changes happen?
You know, I really believe it does. But I also have to say, I do think there's a place for real protest and confrontation. But I think like the best way to do that is first, you know, to first find that place of being and acceptance of the fact that this is the way that it is right now. Like, so it's not like it's an outward resistance that you're having towards the issue, but there's an inner acceptance. There's an inner kind of a non-resistance. I'm not explaining this very well.
Well, you know, I was thinking, I have a good friend who was a peace activist for many, many years, and her father was a military general, and she was a student of Zen Zen meditation, and she said that her own Zen koan was, how do you say yes and no at the same time? And I was thinking about that when reading your book.
Right. Another koan that I like, and it's on one of the cards that she left in the 12x12, was abandon all hope of fruition. So it sounds very negative, but in the context of what I was seeing, what was happening out there, it made complete sense. In other words, don't look for the results. Just focus on the process. Focus 100% on being in the present moment, on the person you're listening to, on the issue you're trying to affect, and don't focus on the results.
And there's this thing which is ancient wisdom, which is seeing the world as being perfect exactly the way it is right now. And, of course, you know, we know it's not perfect. But then you realize there never was any golden age. It's always been some version of this.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think a lot of these sort of these cards, they're like riddles, or they're things to sort of like puzzle over and to just bring you into a more philosophical and deeper perspective on your life around you. So it's not like when you say like that's from the Tao Te Ching, you know, the world is perfect, it cannot be changed. I don't know if they're really saying it's perfect. They're saying that it is. It is how it is right now. And it's perfect in the sense that there's a kind of a balance in everything. You know, I haven't fully figured it out yet, but I do think that those questions about polarities are very interesting. Like the fact that to have anything quote-unquote bad, you have to have a good. Everything is weighing itself out with something else. So it's all necessary.
There's some quotations in the book that I loved, and one of them was the following. When you see worthiness, praise it. When you see unworthiness, trace it. Mm. How did you use, especially the first part is easy, but the last part, when you see unworthiness, trace it. How did you use that idea?
Well, usually, like, you know, the idea of tracing it means whatever your unworthiness, like whatever the negative thing that you're seeing out there, you know, someone else's behavior, like a loved one's behavior, or some problem with, you know, warfare or climate change. It's a good practice to sort of trace it back to the source, you know, like trace it back to your own life. And then you kind of see that you're also part of it completely, and then you can work on yourself and not just be constantly focusing on these external things that are kind of hard to change. Like, it allows you to really look at your inner space.
The question of forgiveness comes up, and you were attacked several times, as you describe in the book, by gangs of basically thugs, and the residual rage from those experiences is something you write about. How did being in this space and thinking about things in these ways affect that residual stuff that you had about being attacked?
That's a great question. I mean, I think what happened was just being out there with all the space and time and kind of freedom, you know, it just allowed all these things to kind of come up and to face them more directly, you know, without all the distractions that are in our typical life. And that's why I also would say to anyone listening that it's just a great idea to do this type of a retreat in general. And I think the forgiveness comes about through just allowing the anger to come up. Like you mentioned that I was attacked several times by gangs in Amsterdam, Boston, and Providence. And just to kind of like let that go, you know, just forgive those people that attacked you, because in every case, it's like they were acting out of their reality, which is actually tied up with the whole flat world logic, you know, with a very unjust kind of a society with a lot of inequalities and a lot of tensions and materialism. And, you know, we live actually in a country, and I can see it very clearly having been outside of the country for 10 years, you know, it's a kind of a pressure cooker, this society. It's the most advanced industrial economy on earth. And that's possible through this highly competitive system that we've set up. So I think that these people, even the people that attacked me, are part of that system. You know, it's ironic, in fact, that I've lived in Africa and in war zones in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Colombia, you know, all these places I've never been attacked or hurt. But then in these industrial countries like the U.S. and Europe, that's where I've experienced the violence. And in each case, I found that it was coming out of, like, the overall cultural context.
And did knowing that help you to let go of the, I don't know, I think of it as sort of primate anger about it.
Yes, absolutely. And I experienced that anger very raw form. It did, knowing that, but not just knowing it mentally, but knowing it deep down. You know, that's the sort of meditative aspect of the 12 by 12 experience. It's like you come into this deeper level where you know you're completely interconnected with your attackers. Like, there's absolutely no difference. You know, it's one sort of energy field, if you will. And that's when you start to feel compassion. It's almost like I saw myself in them completely, and I understood them. And then I was able to completely let it go.
There's another quotation in the book that kind of speaks to that, I think. And you write, everything comes from the earth. It's fine to grasp this intellectually, once again, touch, breathe, and eat this reality feels like a reconciliation with a loved one after a long feud. I love that.
Yeah, that's, thank you. I mean, yeah, it's this idea of reconnecting with Pachamama, as the Bolivians call it, you know, Mother Earth. You know, to squeeze things, touch things. You know, even walking through New York City, I'm constantly touching a tree or a bush or, you know, taking off my shoes, walking on the grass, you know. Any way that we can touch the planet helps create that softness in our own life, and I think it's kind of contagious, you know. A lot of people spend their time looking for four-leaf clovers out there in North Carolina. I mean, that's the type of activity that these leisureologists are doing. You know, I think that slowing down, rejecting time poverty, the idea that we have to keep doing stuff, allows you to reconnect with the earth.
We're talking to William Powers, author of the book 12 by 12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. So, what are you doing now?
Well, I'm a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. It's a progressive think and do tank in New York. So, I'm responsible for sustainable forestry activities. I do a little bit of research and writing on that. We're working on climate change in terms of how that connects with forestry. And, you know, we've got a project where actually the book is being used to promote some of the ideas in it of, you know, the soft world and new approaches to ecology, like, on a deeper level. So we're going to be in the fall going out to universities around the country. And in fact, if there's anyone in New Mexico who would like to have me come and speak in the fall at a university, we'd be happy to book that. Trying to inspire students to think outside of, like, the typical business or government type of jobs and, like, doing a year of kind of earth core, like, service to the planet in some way or another, either here or abroad, and giving them options, like actually providing, you know, 1,000 different things that they could do besides the traditional stuff. So, you know, overall, I think what we're trying to do is create another culture around sustainability, you know, where you get a critical mass of people, mostly younger people, who then would form networks with each other that are based around sustainability. So it's almost like in the 60s, how there was this huge counterculture that came up and then disappeared for various reasons, or, you know, didn't actually, like, really make that jump to a full-scale change in our society. But I think that we need to work at that level, you know, of creating a subculture that takes on a critical mass where it then becomes the culture.
It's interesting when you say that the 60s didn't really make the jump into becoming a full-fledged culture. And I often wonder, there was so much, and it was partly the fault of the media, I suppose, but there was so much animosity between the so-called culture and the counterculture, whose residue is still with us today. And I was thinking about that when you said and when you wrote the stuff about when you really fight directly, you energize the other side. And it seems like the way you're doing it now and the way a lot of people are doing it now is not fighting. They're just doing it and kind of providing a model or a pattern of something else.
Right. I think that's a wonderful way to approach it. The individual level, Because, you know, with the environmental issue especially, it's like we can just do things right now in our lives just easily, you know, just the way we consume, just to never use disposable cups, to think before taking any kind of transportation, like, can I avoid this, or can I, like, walk or not go? There's, you know, 100 little decisions like that that we can make all the time. And each time you make a decision in that way, it's changing the culture in a small way. Now, of course, we don't want to stop at that level. There's a second level, which is then looking at policy change. You know, but I think once you foster a deeper consciousness, that's what then brings about the impetus and the political will towards the policy change. For example, you know, we need to finally pass a clean energy bill in this country to, you know, promote the clean economy. And we need to do, we need to have policies about quality of life. You know, I think we should have a 35-hour work week policy and other types of things that allow more free time and more leisure.
There was an interesting, in the end, after you leave the cabin, there's a little, I guess, sort of epilogue where you end up back in Africa. You're in Liberia, mm-hmm. and you'd been to Africa before. And one thing that happens to you there, maybe as a direct or indirect result of your having taken this retreat, was that you decide to do a selfless action for somebody every day. And the beauty of that, which even in the moment maybe didn't seem pretty mundane, comes back to you in such a wonderful way.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It was a decision that I took to approach things differently, to think about my time there, not just to implement this program. That was a 3-month consultancy where I was overseeing a trade agreement to have only legal timber going into the European Union from Liberia. So it was a certification program. But that was just the background. The foreground was, like, the actual people that I was meeting every day. You know, my assistant and the people in taxi cabs and everything else. And just reaching out to them in whatever way that I could. And the way that it came back to me was very interesting because I'd spent 2 years in Liberia before, and this was only 3 months. The first time, you know, I had somewhat of a going-away party, whatever. But the second time, the amount of love and caring and gifts and everything that just flowed back to me after being there for just 3 months was incredible. I mean, I'd really made an impact because of that interchange, you know, approaching things more mindfully, taking the lessons from Dr. Benton and the 12x12 into my life just completely changed the relationships with others. And I don't think it's possible to not receive when you're giving. I mean, it's like a completely symbiotic process. When you're giving, you're receiving. So it was a beautiful change for me.
And then there's a contrast between that and the work you were doing of trying to get sustainable timber policy passed with the European Union, and that was all going very well. And then the Chinese come in.
It's terrible. I mean, the Chinese impact in Africa right now is absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I've been working in Africa for, you know, some 10, 15 years on and off, and I've seen the growth of, and their development model is like, we'll build this highway or we'll do this project for you if you give us this mine or this forest. It's like a direct exchange of like, and they're building the biggest embassy in West Africa in Liberia right now, a huge Chinese embassy. And I met with the Chinese ambassador and he said that they're doing that because they want, you know, Liberia's wood resources. And what they're doing is they're cutting down these old growth forests that have been there, you know, forever. That's 50% of Liberia. Liberia, as you know, was an American protectorate, freed slaves going back to Africa. And so there was never really a colonizer of Liberia that put in a lot of railroads and roads and so on. So most of Liberia today is still a vast wilderness. And unfortunately, that's being cut down by some of these Chinese companies who have not entered into the sustainable part of this trade agreement, to be shipped to China, where it goes to the sort of coastal factories and is made into furniture that's shipped to, like, IKEA or, you know, other department stores in the U.S. and Europe. So it's a bizarre triangle from, like, you know, West Africa to China and then back, burning incredible amounts of fossil fuels on the way to transport all that stuff.
It's so important to know all these things. I remember once, years ago, I was sitting in my house feeling very lonely, and I looked at the press board cabinets that were my kitchen cabinets and tried to think of where did every single material come from in these cabinets? Where did the labor come from? Where did the energy come from? And then the wall-to-wall rug, and then the formica, and then the light bulbs and everything. And I thought, my God, I may have every single person in the world, in one way or another, embodied in this stuff, in this cheap stuff in my apartment.
Uh-huh. That's a great practice. I hadn't thought of that, but it's a nice practice to go through everything that you have and think about its origin.
It's impossible to do because you have no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And with this example, I mean, what happened with that? Is the Liberian forest basically a lost cause at this point?
Well, no. I mean, I'm just publishing a paper on this. It's called the Forest Law Enforcement Governance and Trade Policy. That actually is a very positive sign. You know, that's what I was working to help set up. But you know, it's like it's the European countries, Germany, France. You know, they've got strong green parties, strong environmental movements. They push for policies where the government bureaucracies of these major countries can only buy sustainable timber. And then when they looked to source that timber, they realized there were no markets. There's not really certified timber, not enough to power those, I mean, to provide for those bureaucracies. So they've been setting up, the Europeans, these programs all over the developing world in forest-rich countries to actually put barcodes on the trees. Not a single tree has left Liberia illegally since this has been set up, at least not to the European side. So it's like the task now is to convince China and the U.S. and also Japan to also join in a similar program. But to me, that's very hopeful, you know, that a major part of the world's economy is just buying sustainable wood.
So back to you and the 12 by 12. When you think about how important those 40 days were for you, and in one way of thinking that's a long time, in another way of thinking it's just a little blip on the screen of a long life, do you need to go back and replenish in order to keep the mindfulness and the presence that you gained in that space?
Well, I mean, what I do is I ask myself sort of, what's my 12 by 12? And I think it's a question that people can ask themselves. You know, it's not that you have to live in a cave and eat roots and berries, or, you know, go live in a tiny, you know, electricity-free, off-the-grid house. It's a way of inspiring a person to, you know, to think more deeply about everything in their life. And I think that even in New York City, you know, I can find my 12 by 12. Like, I don't have a car. I just take public transport. And I plant some of my food in the backyard garden. And I do a lot of little things like that that's nurturing what I call maladjustment to empire. You know, it's an inner state of peace, state of inner peace, but there's a kind of an outward non-compliance, in a way, with the major cultural norms in our society, the ones that are ecocidal, the ones that are, like, harmful to the planet and to others. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't feel like I have to really, you know, once you have those tools, like the tools that I talk about in the book, and, like, you know, these meditation practices and so on, like, they can almost be applied everywhere, even in Times Square, in the middle of Times Square. You can find that sense of peace.
Now, we can't go without talking about your roots in New Mexico. You actually lived and worked here for some time.
I did. I worked there for a couple of years. In the mid-90s, I was the gifted and talented teacher at the Santa Fe Indian School on Cerritos Road. So I kind of helped drop that curriculum, and we had the gifted kids from the different pueblos. I loved it. I absolutely loved Santa Fe. I think it was 3.5 years that I was there, and just a fantastic place. I also spent some time up in Embuto and Dixon. I worked on Stanley Crawford's garlic farm up there for a season, interning with him. I talk about that in the book. And I've been all over New Mexico.
And Stan Crawford is one of the treasures of our state, a pretty prolific writer and somebody who also has really taken that step to live outside of, what did you call it, in a way that's maladjusted to empire.
Right. He certainly has. And the great thing is, just as of last year, they have a vacation rentals by owner, a VRBO place on their farm, where you can actually go and stay in the tower. It's a stone tower on Stan's farm up there in Dixon. And pick your own stuff from the garden and make your own food, you know, and get to know him and Rosemary. And it's a great addition to the farm. It's a way of, I think, reaching out to people and bringing them in.
I wanted to ask you about the writing of this book. When you moved into this cabin, did you have a book in mind?
I did. I was actually going to do another book. I was going to look at the leisure ethic, you know, and I'd been thinking and musing on it for, you know, about a year, and writing, you know, free writing on it. But that whole project kind of just dissolved when I got to the 12 by 12 and this whole new book idea and this whole new way of framing it came up.
Now, were you inspired by Walden and other books where people kind of retreated to nature?
Yes, I think that I find Walden inspiring, or I did when I read it. And I find those examples really inspiring. I'd never done it in quite this way, quite this intensely, and in a way that was so countercultural. So for me, it had a whole new texture to it. And not just the fact that it was a retreat, but it was a strange type of retreat. I mean, here you are in the middle of this rural area of North Carolina, but there was all kinds of social problems all around me, you know, in terms of the cheese scare, the Tylenol PM and heroin cocktail that was going around. And a lot of my neighbors had meth rooms. You know, they would make crystal meth right there. And in fact, one of my neighbors got busted for $15,000 of crystal meth. So it's like this sort of loneliness and isolation in the countryside as well, and the chicken factories and that smell and everything that was going on, the booming sound of the military jets flying over the 12 by 12 before going off to Iraq, those huge bases, military bases in North Carolina. So it's, you know, it's not just living on Walden Pond in the 1800s. I mean, this is a modern-day Walden. This is like 21st century where everything's changed with globalization. So it's a retreat, but you can't escape the social...
I mean, the Virginia Tech Massacre happened when you
right,
were there.
Right, it did, yeah. Yeah, the Virginia Tech Massacre happened, right, and that was very profound, I think, for some of my neighbors as well. I mean, Virginia Tech was just right over the border from North Carolina into the next state, so it was actually kind of close to home geographically.
Well, I hope this book takes its place among some of these other writings, because it's food for a great deal of thought and contemplation, as well as a great story.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate that.
William Powers is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute, and he worked for many years in development aid and conservation in Latin America and Africa. He's the author of many books, and the latest one is called 12 by 12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. It's just wonderful to have spoken with you here on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, it's been great.
And do you have a website if people want to check you out?
Sure, yeah. The website's williampowersbooks.com, and then there's a link to my blog there as well.
And also, Pete, there's, I think, resources for people who want to learn more about permaculture and alternative economies and things like that.
That's right. On williampowersbooks.com, there's also a link to resources, and there's a lot of information about, you know, permaculture, soft economy, and all those issues right there.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Ellen Bradbury. She's with the Santa Fe Writers Conference. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a conference that happens every year, and writers, both experienced and aspiring writers, are invited to attend. But we are in a very interesting moment right now.
We are.
Where it's not about just getting your book published anymore, because the future of books as a phenomenon, and
exactly,
as a physical phenomenon, yeah, is in question.
It is very much in question, and that's what we thought in the past. We've done maybe 27 writers' conferences, a lot, in Santa Fe. We used to do, you know, for poets and fiction and nonfiction and science writers and children's books writers. But right now, it's like the whole game has changed, and the business of finding a publisher, you know, you used to have an agent and an editor, and now people are very well-known authors are driving around with their own books in the trunk of their car trying to sell them.
Right.
So we thought we would really look at this moment, this uncomfortable moment, where you can do a blog, you can do an e-book, you can do publishing on demand, but which one do you want to do, and what's going to suit you the best? And do you want to, you know, devote the rest of your life driving around trying to sell copies of something? So this conference is, we've taken the price way down. I know we can't say the price, but it is not very expensive. And it's June 12th and 13th in Santa Fe at the Hotel Santa Fe. And it's really designed to give people a look at the new landscape of publishing. So do you want to have an ebook? Do you want it to be viral? Do you want to be your own publisher? Do you need an editor? The answer is yes.
No matter what, yes.
You do need an editor. And copyright, because copyright, you know, there's a big Google lawsuit about copyright. And do you want to do global things? And what about rights to foreign rights to books? Foreign rights to books in this country are really being sold at an astonishing rate. So we have somebody talking about that. So it's just a whole new kind of conference for us. We used to do 5 or 6 days of intense, anguishing rewriting,
right,
staying up all night, weeping, and, you know, oh, no, we're not doing that anymore.
This is not, this is a weep-free
conference. It should be weep-free, yeah, at least. Yeah.
So here's the big question. Where's the money now in writing?
Oh, boy, that is a big question. Is there money? Established authors, and we have Kirk Ellis and James McGrath Morrison, Sally Bingham, you know, Kirk Ellis, really big.
Yeah, he wrote the John Adams series,
yeah,
for HBO, among,
yeah,
many other things.
And that, those people whose name can command something can still probably get published. But we also have Dorothy Massey talking about the future of the independent bookstore and what's happening there.
Well, so, that's such an interesting question, too,
yeah,
because independent bookstores have been, as we've talked about on the show many times, have been struggling for the,
yeah,
last couple of,
yeah,
decades. And now they seem to be the only people who actually know their customers. The chains are going,
yeah,
down the tubes.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And, you know, every bookstore turned into a coffee shop.
Right.
That seemed to work pretty well. But I think that there is no single answer. And so what we're hoping to do is help people sort of find their way through these new technologies. And I have to say, we've had some great phone calls from people who don't know how to email.
Oh,
I say, well, you better come right away, because it's not the answer. But we have somebody, Rubina Cohen, is going to talk about social networking. And that, I don't know that that's the answer either, but I think that we want to look at all of this and help people find a niche where they're comfortable with the material that they already have written.
And then the question is, are people reading as much as they used to? And what are they reading?
Well, I think they are reading, and that's the Kindle and all of these new books. And I don't know really if they're reading different things than they have read before. I think there's a great increase in book clubs, you know, which have formed as a sort of social thing, which is really very nice.
Right.
Thank you, Oprah. Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, she's been amazing. But I think that the future of the book, we're not calling it that. We're calling it Publish and Thrive. I don't,
right,
know. Thrive. We hope you thrive. But The future of the book, I think the book will definitely endure. But this is more for writers to try to find their way in this new technology, this new bewildering kind of set of opportunities, none of which seem to be perfect. And we have Donald Lamb, who is a great, lovely old man of publishing. He's going to maybe talk about how it was when you went in and had a 3-martini lunch, and then they gave you a big advance, and you went home and wrote the book. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
So, oh, those were the days.
Yeah, really. Yes.
Ellen Bradbury is with the Santa Fe Writers Conference, which is happening on June 12th and 13th. And the website is SantaFeWritersConference.com. For those of you who don't know how to use a computer or you do email, what's the phone number?
The phone number is 505-982-9301. And I want to say this is co-produced by Creative Santa Fe.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. Podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. Hasta la vista. Ciao.